good? All right, if we could take our seats, please. And I want to make a point of thanking Social Marks Media for sponsoring the refreshment break. So if you get a chance, stop by and tell them thank you. My name is Bob Lagasse. I'm Executive Director of the Mulch and Soil Council, and as it would be, I'm also Executive Director of the Mulch and Soil Research Foundation. And as Chris mentioned earlier today, the Research Foundation has the opportunity to conduct specialty industry scientific research based upon the needs of the industry and the availability of funding from within the industry. And last year, no, 2 years ago, it was at the Nashville meeting, we asked the membership of the council to respond to the issue of spurious claims of spontaneous combustion of mulch and soils in landscape and garden applications. And the industry, within 3 days, provided enough funding for us to hire a technical research outfit here in San Antonio, actually, to conduct that research. And I'm reported on part of this last year in the preliminary report. And as usual, the members gave us tremendous feedback, not the least of which was, in your report, you did not include red and black colorized mulch. Yeah, we didn't. So we went back and redid it. And we're here today to give you a quick overview of this research. You don't need blazing pencils to write this down. The report is available on the Mulch and Soil Research, on the Mulch and Soil Council members area website. So you can just download a copy. It's going to tell you everything I'm going to tell you, but just to give you the overview. And this is a quick 30-minute review of 2 years' worth of research. And mulch fires are really two very different events. There's the large piles, and then there's the claims of fires of spontaneous combustion origin in gardens and landscape applications. Large storage piles, we're very aware of, have a great deal of industry experience. We know the physics of it a little better. Regarding spontaneous combustion having to do with different height, weather, wind, other environmental conditions, and the environmental consequences, which are generally smoke or air pollution and water pollution issues that can become quite expensive. Not to mention the political consequences. If you have too many large pile fires going around the country, you have an enormous impetus for local governments to start regulating what they feel is a deficiency. And we want to avoid that. So large pile fires are an issue in the industry. It's something we want to look more into. But this research focuses on the more narrow review of mulch and landscape and garden applications. What we have known over the years is that it requires an ignition source. That's typically cigarettes, because you generally see these in areas where cars and people aggregate, building entries, parking lots, decks and photo patios, median strips, where cars waiting for the light to change and the flick the cigarette out the window. And I know when I was a smoker, I was very guilty of that. Electrical devices and high voltage lighting has been a source, because mulch covered over lighting sources that overheated. And focused reflections on garden ornaments and low E windows have been rarely reported, but they do exist. Spontaneous combustion, generally in small piles, does not exist. If that were true, we would have pallet loads burning down most Home Depots and Lowe's nationally for the last 30 years, and that just doesn't happen. Small piles, 5 to 10 cubic yards, generally are not an issue. Our research on large piles says you have to exceed 20 feet in height before you start getting areas of concern. You have to be able to generate and retain heat in excess of 175 degrees Fahrenheit before you have to worry about temperatures. Mulch in a 4-inch layer is anecdotally known not to be a spontaneous combustion hazard, but we never had the empirical data that would prove that it couldn't happen. We did fall under attack, and years ago it was a very sporadic claim. We didn't get a lot of issues raised about mulch spontaneous combustion fires because you could generally identify a source. And in the rare occasions that there was a claim made, generally the and a further investigation by fire insurance investigators indicated that they found a source, and there really wasn't a documented claim of spontaneous combustion. Actually, we've never had one. In 2015, the Fire Chiefs Association made a policy decision that they were going to focus on mulch fires, and as such, we started seeing dozens of claims attributing fires to garden mulch. Now, a lot of these claims were that there was an ignition source. There was a cigarette generally involved, but more and more, we began to see claims of spontaneous combustion along with warnings from fire chiefs and fire departments that the general public should be aware that mulch could be a threat to life and property. And that raised our concern. The question here is, why are we concerned about it? Well, obviously, misinformation told often enough with enough assurance or authority of a source generally becomes the truth. Kind of like a Green New Deal. Growing consumer fear could impact sales. If you've got people that the public would trust, like a fire marshal, saying this could burn your house down, how is that going to affect our sales? And if we become a known cause, that draws attention of insurance companies and the insurance industry, and we become endangered for product liability and increased cost of doing business. So, as I said, at the annual meeting in Nashville, we asked the industry for support on behalf of the Mulch and Soil Research Foundation. And the foundation is a 501c3 research scientific organization, and industry can give gifts to the foundation for dedicated research, and it's tax deductible. So everybody that made a gift, and we raised $67,000 in 3 days to do that. And that also makes us eligible for grants and tax deferral gifts. The board of directors is coincidentally the board of directors of the Mulch and Soil Council, which at the time was Catherine Lewis, Chris Littlefield, Byron Morgan, Kent Yoder, Roger, and Jim Weber and myself. So the sponsors that gave donations to fund this research are listed here, and we owe them all a debt of gratitude as the foundation and as the industry, because it was without their gifts we would not have been able to do this research. And this is a one-of-a-kind research. With that money, we hired SWRI, the Southwest Research Institute, which is a $650 million research organization, has a multi-million dollar fire study department headed by, among other things, Dr. Matthew Blaze. You can't make that up. Okay. It was a three-phase study. The first was to identify which mulch material was most likely, or materials were most likely to be subject to spontaneous combustion. The next phase was to characterize that material under what conditions would that exist. And the third was to perform a heat profile test and actually make it combust so that we could record how that would happen. We did identify nationally over 30 different types of mulch that are commonly sold across the country. We summarized the prominent types in each region, and we collected samples from what we felt were the most reliable sources for each of these, being cypress, shredded pine, cedar mulch, shredded hardwood, shredded lodgepole pine. Plus, we went back and added black and red colorized mulch after we omitted them in the first round. The preliminary screening test, obviously the first objective was to identify which mulch was at the highest risk, which means in accordance to fire protocol means the lowest decomposition rate and the highest heat holding capacity. So you have to start decomposition faster, you have to hold temperature longer to create spontaneous combustion. So which among all of these happened? We used several differential analysis studies to determine which ones. First, the differential scanning calorimetry and the gravimetry analysis to measure the temperature at which the materials start to decompose and the extent of their mass loss. The lower the decomposition temperature, the more likely spontaneous combustion could exist. The chart here would show, among all the items that did, shredded lodgepole pine lost the most, or started to decompose fastest, had the lowest, highest rate of decline, but then it leveled out and did not lose the most. What lost the most was shredded hardwood, but it was only second in the rate of decline. So we took those two, since we couldn't pick one clearly, we took both of those and put them through a second round of tests to see which one would be the most likely candidate to fail. Obviously, the results from the DCE and TSA was seven mulch types, shredded lodgepole pine started to decompose at the lowest temperature, followed by the shredded hardwood, but the shredded hardwood lost the most mass more quickly. So we went into a self-heat mode to try to identify which of the two was the worst. It wasn't enough to self-heat. You also have to generate more heat than you release in temperature. So yeah, it's a retention issue. So we ran another test, ASTM C518, which measures the steady state thermal transmission through a flat slab, which is basically at 2, 3, and 4 inch levels, we measured how much transfer heat can be from one plate to the other. And you charge it up and you put it through the sample and how much reaches the other end, and you measure how much was retained, because retention is the issue. We ran those in triplicate, and we found that, hold on. We found that the shredded hardwood mulch was slightly better as an insulator, which means it was a better aid in retaining heat in a pile or layer. Then we characterized the material. So our key test sample was shredded hardwood mulch. Again, whether it was colorized or not made no difference at all. The shredded pieces in the hardwood was 1/2 to 3 inch long, 1/4 to 1 inch wide. The water content was 61%, and there were fatty acids included in the process, linoleic and arachidonic acids, and nothing was atypical of what we expected to find. Typical metals were found. We then characterized the material in what they called a basket test, and the official name of it is the UN Manual of Tests, but it's actually a 4-inch cube that is loaded with 9 sensors. You put it in a oven at 140 degrees for 24 hours. And if the temperature, here's a sample of it. If the temperature rises greater than 60 degrees C in 24 hours, then it's a self-heating materials. Mulch rose 12.6 degrees C. It is not classified as a self-heating material. So it will not naturally self-heat under these conditions. Characterize the basket test, the activation. One of the things that we're trying to do is find out how much energy does it take to create a fire, a spontaneous fire in mulch in a landscape application. So the activation energy is how much energy goes into creating the heat profile. And for straw and grass, it takes 45 to 90 kilojoules per mole to combust straw and glass. Wood pellets, 70 to 80 kilojoules. For shredded hardwood mulch, 195 kilojoules. That's like 2.5 times what it takes for other materials. So it's not prone to it. It's not a self-heater. It takes a lot of energy to do it. So then we use that to determine the crossing point temperature. And the crossing point temperature is you put it in an oven. Again, you start at 140 degrees, and you crank the oven up 10 degrees C every half hour until the inside temperature matches the outside temperature. That's your crossing point. That's your combustion point. It took 200 degrees C or 392 degrees Fahrenheit to reach crossing point. So if your ambient temperature is 392 degrees in your garden, you're in risk of spontaneous combustion of your mulch. And it's probably a long time ago you no longer cared about that. But that's the amount of energy it actually takes to reach that claim. The heat profile test was then taken and done in an intermediate test. This is a 4x4 cube, okay? And we took it and stuck it in a 2x2 foot cube, all right? And we added samples of wood-based and peat-based potting mix, including with and without fertilizer. There's a lot of fire companies, fire marshals that make an issue of, well, it's got fertilizer in it, so it's an fertilizer is an oxidizing agent, therefore you're going to self-combust. Not true. This is a sample we ran indoor and outdoor samples as a control. This is a sample of indoor where you have 4 pots, one wood-based, one peat-based, with and without fertilizer, and a 2x2 cube of shredded hardwood mulch. This is a setup for the indoor. For the outdoor, we had, this was done at SWI facilities here in San Antonio. They're about a couple of miles from where we are right now. And we monitored wind temperature and direction, ambient temperature, humidity, and of course, for the mulch cube and the potting soil. Here's a profile. If you want to note that on the indoor cubes, TC3 is the dead center, which means that's a 2-foot cube, so that's 1 foot in on all sides. On the outdoor, TC17 is dead center. Then we had probes on each surface and intermediate. The profile heat for indoor, we measured weight, temperature, and humidity because, again, weight loss is an issue. Outdoor, weight, temperature, humidity, wind speed, wind direction, soils temperature, and the duration of the test was 6.5 weeks. It actually was 7 weeks during the height of summer. Now, we started this project, and the first run, we finished the preliminary data in April. And I said, well, do you want to do the outside test now? And I said, it's April. It's spring. They're going to say we did the test, you know, in the beautiful springtime. So let's put it in the ugly summertime. In the ugly summertime in San Antonio, the average temperature was 112. Right? Much different than the average temperature in April. Nobody can claim we rigged that one. Now, the heat profile test, the average outdoor high and low was 107 and 73. The outdoor humidity, 57. The average indoor was 79, and the relative humidity was 54. So here's the heat profile for the indoor mulch cube, average temperature by week. All right, this is the indoor mulch cube, and you're going to see that basically it tracks the ambient temperature is the dark black line. And it's tracking for all 7 weeks pretty much consistent with ambient temperature. No significant heat rise, no self-heating, etc. If you look at the outdoor mulch cube, again, the heavy black line is the ambient air temperature that was taken during that week. You'll see some rise in temperature, but it's only 5 or 6 degrees, 105, 106, when it's down here at 85. These were the maximum temperatures during this weekly period. Right, this is not runaway heating. Remember, it's 105 degrees, 106 degrees, 107 degrees. What's the activation temperature? Huh? This is Fahrenheit, too. The activation temperature is 397 degrees. We're way far away from anywhere that might be an issue. If you look at the potting soils, we've got the these are the indoor temperatures here. Again, not a whole lot of fluctuation over ambient, which is a heavy black line. And the outdoor temperatures here, again, not much fluctuation in ambient temperature over the black line. And the most significant would be maybe 5 degrees or less than 5 degrees that's outdoor. That's peat moss non-fertilizer. That's the big spike. Peat moss non-fertilizer. Where'd my thing go? All right, peat moss non-fertilizer. Again, way outside of the parameters that would be required. So, in general, mulch was observed in 2x2 mesh cube, 2x2 foot mesh cubes, both indoor and out. The cube size was selected to create a pile that is much thicker than reasonably installed in landscape application while allowing ambient air exposure to the environment. The maximum recommended depth of application was 4 inches. You know, remember the TC-17 probe was dead center. That's 12 inches. That's 3 times the depth recommended in any direction of ambient temperature relationship. The thinner mulch depths would be expected to pose less risk of spontaneous combustion because the pile would be less insulating. Ambient maximum temperatures were only slightly lower than mulch cube internal temperatures, which indicates that the mulch was retaining heat due to its insulating properties and not self-heating. That's what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to cool and insulate the soil. Right? It's not supposed to self-heat. And again, one of the examples is, in a large pile, you have an accumulation of heat from under the pile or within the pile. If you're trying to accumulate heat over a thin, large surface area application, that's an extremely difficult thing to hold heat in, because it's the surface area releases more heat than it can retain. Based on the DSC and TGA data, the decomposition temperature for shredded hardwood mulch was 200 degrees C. The maximum temperature was 113 F, which is much less than the decomposition temperature. Based on these results, it's very unlikely that mulch in a landscape application would pose a risk of spontaneous combustion without an external ignition source. It can still catch fire, but it's not spontaneous combustion. The math doesn't say it can happen. We've never had a case that has been verified that it was spontaneous combustion. If you haven't found the source, you need to look harder. The potting mix. Likewise, four 8-inch flower pots were set up alongside the mulch cubes to observe the wood-based potting soil and peat-based potting soil with and without fertilizer. Based upon these results, it is unlikely that potting soil, wood or peat-based, with or without fertilizer in an 8-inch flower pot would pose a risk of spontaneous combustion. Now, we had to arbitrarily pick an 8-inch pot, some factor that would be what we thought would be common on a deck, et cetera, or you would end up for every possibility be studying this thing for decades and never come to a conclusion. But overall, I think what we found was that we now have data, and the only data that does exist that proves scientifically this can't happen. Spontaneous combustion claims for a landscape and garden application is not a sustainable claim. So, what do we do next? Well, we feel we've debunked the myth, but us knowing the answer isn't enough. So, the next step is for the foundation to have the SWRI and use their credentials to create a scientific article that's placed in a fire science journal. A juried journal, so it's done by experts, so we can have it entered into the official literature that this cannot happen, this exists, and it's unlikely to happen. SWRI just submitted the final draft of the technical article that was reviewed by the Foundation Board, yesterday? So we expect with the approval of that, we will move forward and begin the process. It could take a year to go through the process of a jury journal submission. You have to submit it. It's got to be accepted by the journal. It's got to go out to a peer review. That could take 6 months. And it comes back, corrections are made, re-reviewed, et cetera, and then it's finally published. But once it appears in a juried journal, it is the established science. In the meantime, we have a copy of the final report. If you would like a copy of the final report, it is now available, and you can download it off the MSC website from the members area in the documents file. And it will tell you everything that I just told you. It does it more eloquently. So, again, I want to thank the sponsors and the product suppliers and the reviewers who have been engaged in this process for more than 2 years. Nothing like this happens quickly, but when you're setting the absolute or creating the absolute authority for something that is useful in the industry. We don't expect it to be quick. We just want it to be accurate and useful. So, are there any questions? Okay. All right. One of the things that we're going to want to do is I have Google searches all the time for articles, news stories, anything where a fire marshal or somebody in a municipality says this is spontaneous combustion. We don't pick them all up. If you find some or you come across any, please send me a copy. We can send this report and say not true. Yes, sir.
This isn't related to the study, but it is fire related. We're going through a site plan review of one of our locations right now, and the locality is asking for what do we do post fire. We just basically say we don't have fires. But that's what they're asking for. So those are the feedback from the group as to if they've ever had that experience with the locality and how to handle it.
Okay, has anybody had that request from a locality? I assume what they're looking is cleanup, COD, BOD, you know, runoff issues. I'd be happy to work with you on that. Let's get together later. Because I've never heard of that. Okay. And again, you're my best resource to track these things down, because things happen constantly. The internet is omnipresent. The other thing is, what happens in France can affect you in Ohio. Claims made are no longer, it used to, if something happened overseas, if something happened in another country, it would take months or years for that information to filter through the system. That stuff happens in minutes now. So any claim that we see that is not based upon scientific fact, or should be, we should be refuting, we need your assistance to point that out to us so that we can take action with it and inform the poorly informed. Okay, any other questions? All right, the next topic that the foundation engaged in, and you have not heard this, so this is another 2-year. Oh, that's not what I want. This is another 2-year event. Quit. Okay. Proposition 65, risk assessment for mulch and soil products. Now, I'm going to premise this from the very beginning. This project immediately focused on Proposition 65 labeling issues. It is not limited to that. You need to think of it in terms of any claim made against your product for chemical or material safety. What was done for Proposition 65 can be done for any safety claim relating to a mulch or soil product. Because what's significant is that the foundation is invested in doing the exposure assessment research through an industrial hygiene study that makes this make sense. And it's not the kind of thing that many people have the time or expertise to invest in. So, but nominally, This is aimed at California Proposition 65 labeling. And for years, California Proposition 65 has required that persons in the course of doing business in the state of California must provide a clear and reasonable warning prior to exposing any person to any known chemical to the state to be a cancer or reproductive harm risk. Okay? Things you may not know. It does not matter how your product got to California. It does not matter that you did not know your product was being sold in California. If you put your product into a distribution center and the distribution center sent it out there without your knowledge, you're still bound by the Proposition 65 labeling requirements. Whether you knew it or not, whether you were involved or not, it's your label. They will hold you responsible. Now, they changed the law in last year, in 2018, last August, and not only did they require that you ramp up and put up the label, they made the label more specific. You have to call out the chemical. You have to call out whether it's a cancer risk or a reproductive harm risk. So if you've got two or three things, only one, if you got two reproductive harm risks, you can actually have to say product chemical A and chemical B, or material A and B are known to California B cause reproductive harm, or item C is known to be a cancer risk. So you can end up with multiple labels on your product. Or you could be facing multiple accusations by somebody against your product saying that your product is a health risk that is not related to California. So we'll move on. Here's the confusing part, because you can have an OMRI listed label but be required to put a Proposition 65 warning on it. So you say, this is OMRI listed for organic use, but it'll kill you, according to Proposition 65. That's what you call a mixed message to your end user. Okay. And we found out it's not true. So the enforcement vehicle through California is really a strange vehicle too, because Proposition 65 can first be initiated by a state attorney general or any jurisdictional attorney general. If the AG declines, a citizen suit can be submitted to the AG for approval and 60 days notice. Okay, so if they say, we think we have a case, and here's our case, and if the AG agrees, then that can proceed without the state supervision. The private entity can sue you. It can be a citizen, but usually it's a litigation mill. There's about a dozen law firms that generate about 80% of the Proposition 65 litigation in the state of California. And it's a moneymaker. If approved, yeah. Now the AG can decline. He said, I don't think you have a good enough case. You can't bring this case forward, and they would be prohibited from doing that. But generally, the AG would submit, and the citizen would move forward. Once the product is identified in violation, then the litigators would seek other like companies, like products, and they just go through the industry. Right now, they're marching through the leather industry for violations of cesium that's used to treated leather. And apparently, it's minor levels over the safe harbor limit, so everybody's having to pony up with warnings on purses and belts and other matters. Most small businesses don't have the financial resources to prove they're under the safe harbor limits for their products, so litigators pocket the settlement and fees. So if you pay a fine or you agree to pay a penalty, you're paying it to the litigator, not to the state. Typical products or chemicals or compounds in our industry are arsenic, beryllium, cadmium. Chromium's on the list, but only hexavalent. Cobalt, lead, nickel. These are not uncommon, and they can't exist in background levels in the state, and therefore they could end up in products, or at least they can be claimed to end up in product. The exception is an exposure for which the person responsible can show that the exposure does not have a significant risk of harming lifetime exposure at the level in question for substance known to create cancer, and that's important. Cancer is a lifetime risk, or reproductive harm, which is a single day event. Translate that to your product is exempt from Proposition 65 labeling if you can prove user exposure for your product is 1/1000th of the safe harbor limit set by California. That's a burden of proof that an individual company might find difficult to do, so the foundation took that project up. When you're talking about 1/1000th, you're talking about NSRs, NSRLs and MADLs, so you're talking about, for arsenic, 0.06 inhaled limit for NSRL, and that's micrograms per day, or MADL, that's micrograms per day, 10 micrograms per day, or less than 10 micrograms per day, other than inhaled. And you can probably see the chart, but it all focuses down to whether or not you can get below these levels in a combination of constant dose and exposure. How much, how long? You can determine how much with a lab test. How long becomes an issue. So you need to do a exposure assessment. So the foundation researched exposure, and we actually fitted workers with specific task analysis materials. It was a pump that had a filter on it, and it sucked in air at a given rate while they were doing certain tasks that are common to our products. In this case, potting plants using a potting mix, preparing plots for planting using landscape soils, soil amendments, and compost, spreading mulch using medium nuggets, spreading mulch using red mulch, and spreading mulch using a shredded mulch. The red mulch was a fine, the shredded mulch was a coarse mulch. And then we had teams actually doing these projects wearing calibrated equipment. So while they were doing the project, it was sucking in air and gathering dust samples the whole time. They did 80-minute duration tests three times. So that's 300 or 240 minutes, which was more than we were required to do. The mass of dust was then divided by the samples yielded in the calibrated exposure expressed in micrograms per cubic meter, which we converted to micrograms per hour, and the results indicated that exposure to our products during these common tasks, whether they were worker or consumer, ranged from 287.5 to 587.5 micrograms per hour. So that's your exposure. All right. You can see here, the industrial hygienist is fitting one of our test subjects with a sample. This is the air intake unit. The pump unit is right here. The intake is up on the shoulder. We were spreading mulch. This is actually the number of people that were involved in the field test, because we have to extend to Chris Littlefield our appreciation for destroying his property while we did this, because we dug up plots, we put down mulch. You know what you do with a 4-inch deep tarp, 10x10 tarp of mulch that's been spread out? You no, touch it.
Not where you think you're going to do it.
Yeah.
It's heavy.
it's heavy. Again, potting plants, doing garden plots, doing three different types of mulches, all while doing these intake tests. This is the potting plants here. This were 4x4 plots, and we actually planted them with tomatoes and, you know, I don't know if they survived, but we put them in the ground. And these were the 10x10 plots of mulch that we were doing. Once the total dust exposure over 1 man-hour period for a particular task with a certain product was determined, then we converted the total dust exposure to an exposure to the specific Prop 65 chemical. So we've got what the exposure is, how much dust are you creating, how much are you being exposed to, and that's total dust. So then you have to determine in your product how much arsenic do you have. All right, that times the exposure times the time gives you the risk assessment. The calculation is expressed in the amount of total dust per hour times the number of hours that the task was hypothetically required, which yields the total dust exposure. We did most of our calculations based upon 8 hours. Now, consumers are not going to do 8 hours of potting plants, but we did that for worst case scenario. And keep in mind, the exposure for items on the list for cancer is lifetime. For reproductive harm, it's 1 day. It's a maximum allowable daily exposure. So most of your attacks in California will come based upon the MADL, not the NSRL. The value is multiplied and the concentration of Proposition 65 chemical converted from micrograms, milligrams per kilogram, which is parts per million that you'll typically get from your lab, to micrograms per microgram to yield the exposure to the subject chemical, which is compared to the NSRDL. Again, we have information that will explain all of this. We have the total report that you can download. So this is just for your information and if you want to ask questions during this. The formula actually works out number of hours of exposure in a day times the dust exposure for the product in micrograms per hour times the presence of the chemical in milligrams per kilogram converted to micrograms per microgram gives you exposure in micrograms per day. Totally forget that now. You don't need that. In the end, what the project ultimately did was create an Excel sheet that does all this math for you. But you need to understand what this is, all right, and how you can apply this to other than Proposition 65 labeling. Again, in a step-by-step, the report will walk you through. You have five options of type of activity, everything from potting plants to spreading mulch. You would select the activity, each activity according to the risk or the industrial hygiene assessment has a certain micrograms per hour established exposure. Right? We're the only ones that have that. We're the only ones that did that research. And if anybody says we think that's wrong, prove it. Okay, because we think it's right. And we have documentation that it's right. Then you estimate the number of hours a person, consumer, or employee. So we also did it in terms of landscape professionals and greenhouse employees will engage in a product and task activity in any day. Once an estimate of hours is determined, in step two, hourly total dust exposure is multiplied by this value. Now, there are some notes in the report, and there are some variances that can, if you have a specialty product that you would not be doing for 8 hours, If you go through the end of this, you put in 8 hours, and you come up with a number that's not acceptable, go back and look at what your assessments were in the hours. Okay? Because a lot of it is exposure per hour. If you can justify these values are only an estimate, and there can be a large variation, again, we said 8 hours. If your exposure would only be 4 hours, cut it down to 4 hours if you can justify that change in the data. And that would halve your risk. Enter the concentration proposition 65 chemical resulting from the laboratory analysis. And there is an asterisk here. If you're working in the state of California, you need to use a California certified laboratory. Not any laboratory can do work that is accepted by California. We have one that we can recommend, was SunTech. Very good lab. They were very prompt. We got a really good price from them, and they are certified for the state. If it's not a California state issue, I assume you can use any lab that you want to calculate your own risk issue on your product. But you will get that report in parts per million or milligrams per kilogram. You need to convert that to micrograms per kilogram, and then convert that to micrograms per micrograms, because you're talking about parts per billion, parts per trillion, or 1,000th of the NSR level. You multiply the value of step 3, exposure, by the value from step 5, the dose, I'm sorry, step 6, the dose, to determine the total amount of dust value per in micrograms per day, which is your risk assessment. All right. Then you compare that to this chart, which is your NSRL and MADL limits for the state of California. And I assume for any other state, if you're under these, you're good, because these are the most stringent that we're aware of in the country. And again, arsenic, you're talking about 0.06 micrograms per day inhaled, less than 10 micrograms per day MADL for any other exposure, which would be ingestion, contact, etc. Lead, 15 micrograms per day oral, 0.5 micrograms per day maximum allowable daily limit. Proposition 65, warning applicability, is determined by whether or not you're under these limits, these NSRL and MADL limits. And again, if you're being attacked for it, you're more than likely being attacked for your MADL, because it's a one day as opposed to a lifetime. So if you really can't come under the MADL, then you need to go back and reassess your product. And after determination of whether or not Proposition 65 warnings are required, the calculation should be maintained in order to defend against allegations not based upon a comparable scientific exposure or on the basis of an allegation of a violation that cannot be shown because there is no knowing or intentional exposure due to reasonable application of regulatory exposure assessment. That's what the lawyer put in, but what it means is keep a copy to CYA and keep it over time. So when you do chemical analysis of your materials, it wouldn't hurt to run it through this data sheet and keep that data sheet, assuming you get the appropriate result. The data sheet is very simple. It's user entry on product name. You would select, this is a selectable field, one of the five categories, which would be planting, potting, mulch, large, medium, small mulch. The date, the assessors, and this would normally be your laboratory's name. Your lab code or number. Then this would be for each one of these events, it's going to call up the appropriate, in this formula, it's going to call up the appropriate exposure in micrograms per hour. But you have to tell it which chemical you're looking for, whether it's arsenic, lead, cadmium, whatever. That's self-selecting. It's a pull-down sample. You have to give it the number of hours that your customer would be exposed. It will calculate the rest. You have to put in the lab amount for your material. So if your lab said you had 2 parts per million or 2 milligrams per kilogram of arsenic, you would put in 2, and it would calculate. And if this, if this number there it is. If this number right here shows up black, you're good. If it shows up red, you need to go take another look at what you're doing. Save, print. Now, I only had an hour to do both of these, and it's 1 hour, and I've done both of these. There is one more issue. California, and this is California specific, every other state and OSHA has an NSRL for wood dust, but California does not, and it's on its Proposition 65 list, but it has no NSRL. So any exposure to wood dust, according to the state of California, is inappropriate. So we have taken our data and our risk assessment and our industrial hygiene report, and we have prepared a rather extensive, I think it was a 15-page memo to the State of California Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment last November, and asked them to, based upon the information that we were able to provide and the samples that we had done, to assign an NSRL for wood dust, for mulch and soil products, and if they could not come to see that an NSRL was appropriate, to give us a letter of exemption, which they have the authority to do whether they would or not is the issue. And they have not responded to that request as of yet, but we are still inquiring. So we hope that we can get for our industry an exemption or, well, hopefully an NSRL, but prefer or at least an exemption from the wood dust exposure risk. I want to thank our donors. These were the people involved in providing both the funding and the products and the manpower that went into 2 years of research here. This is an explanation of the council, but we've already, or the foundation, but we've already told you what it is. This pretty much concludes the MSRF's research projects currently that we have. We don't have anything pending, but we are looking for any industry issues that need the kind of muscle that the foundation can pull together, giving your support to solve a problem that helps everybody. These two, we're very proud of these two pieces of research. We think they are well documented. They are speak directly to some key issues, and they are pocketbook issues. So any questions? All right, again, these are available on the MSC website. You go to the members area, log in, and I'm going to speak to this in the business meeting too, because you say, I don't know what my login is. I will give you a trial login for the next 30 days, and then you can work out with Shelley what your real login should be. But you'll be able to log in, and you can look at both of these reports and the Excel sheet. And again, and you don't need to know everything that's in this report, but in order for the Excel sheet to make sense and to do it right, you kind of got to understand the basics of it. You don't have to do the hand calculations. So, any questions? Shelley's back there waving notes at me. So the next item that we're going to do is the business meeting. And one of the first things we're going to do is elect new directors. And ballots are available out on the table where the break was. You get one ballot per company. There is a ballot out there with your company name on it. And one rep needs to go out there and collect that ballot and bring it back in here, and we'll start the business meeting immediately. Thank you. There's what?
Stuff happening in your industry from an environmental perspective. I'd like to have a discussion with you about it.
Good.
And I don't know if it's...
Well, not good that there's an issue.
Right. I don't know if it's a multi set of councils or if our country will fund some research on its own. Either they have a plan or they are just being involved in the industry.
Happy to talk about it. All right. If we can take our seats. All right, lock and load. Oh no, somebody said that.